gentlemen, welcome to minute 34 of season 12 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we dig our way through the 1994 film The Shawshank Redemption, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is David Brook of Blueprint Review. Welcome back to the show once again, David.
Hello, pleasure as always.
Yes. Now, maybe we'll get a little bit of the fresh May air at this point. Who knows? So, minute 34 begins with Red continuing to tell us his beliefs and ends with Red stating the price. So, we left things off yesterday with Red basically explaining to all of us how things work in Shawshank for Andy, you know, over the years. What things are good, what things are bad, you know, that type of thing. At this point, he continues and says, and I also believe if things had gone on that way, this place would have gotten the best of him. But then, in the spring of 1949, the powers that be decided that, and I love the way that they do this transition to Norton at this point.
Yeah.
You know, because he's narrating, and then as he's narrating, you get someone to actually, you know, say the next line.
Yeah, it continues
of what's
on
being said. You know, so it's nicely done. But before we get there, I actually want to go back a little bit because, you know, when Red is giving his dire part of his premonition here, where at the beginning where he says, and I also believe if things had gone on that way, this place would have gotten the best of him. You know, we talked yesterday about the fact that Andy was in the laundry room doing stuff by himself. But the shot that they give us of him is a very desperate shot of Andy. You know, it looks like the type of shot that would fit into a horror film because of the look on Andy's face.
He just looks kind of dead at this point, dead inside. That's at this point. He's just kind of, he's just totally worn down by this abuse.
I don't know if it's totally worn down by the abuse. It's totally worn down by having to try and fend off the abuse. I think that's more the way that you can look at it.
Yeah. And just the, again, the, I say this word all the time, but the whole monotony of it all, really. Because as I say, it's just, he's almost dead inside.
Right. And I like the way that the camera starts zooming in on him as it switches to the outside. You know, and at that point, they're already starting, Red is starting to already tell us about something that's going to, that happened in the spring of 49. And then we get a shot of Norton. And Norton says, the roof of the license plate factory needs resurfacing. I need a dozen volunteers for a week's work. As you know, special detail carries with it special privileges. Little does he know what that really means. You know. So it got me thinking, you know, like, why do you think it's like a known aspect of prison life that inmates make license plates?
I don't know. Does it come from a film? Perhaps. I don't know. It's weird how everyone seems to be a classic kind of thing.
Exactly. Do you think it's real? Do you think that the people in real prisons make license plates?
I don't think they do in the UK, but I don't know. I always get led to believe that it's true for the States, but I might be totally off the mark. I might have watched too many movies.
Okay, well, first of all, it is true. And what percentage of all license plates do you think are made by prisoners incarcerated?
I feel like it wouldn't be that many these days. I don't know, maybe 10%.
80%. 80% of all license plates are made in prisons. You know, and the irony is, as you mentioned, it's a Hollywood stereotype, but it's real. I mean, the main reason that they do it is because it's a reliable, low-cost manufacturing pipeline for state governments, which helps keep the inmates occupied and teaches them about working in industrial type jobs. I mean, the fact that every car needs a license plate, so there's there's a demand for it, so they're always making them. And the idea is that the states get to also pay less than minimum wage for people to be creating the these license plates. Inmates don't make very much money on these type of things. They make less than $1 an hour for doing this type of thing. And how long does it really take to make a plate? So, the government is making a very large profit on the fact that they're making them very cheaply and are able to charge people an arm and a leg, basically. The idea is that in prisons, the inmates are not allowed to make things that they can sell outside, but if the government wants them to produce things for the government, then that's allowed. And since license plates are something that basically only the state has the right to issue and to sell, so this is definitely considered a state product, and there's very little competition, with other companies that might try to outbid, or I mean, they probably won't be able to underbid anyway. The way that it works is that inmates have to show up on time. They have safety protocols, and they get to operate heavy machinery, metal presses, digital printers, blanking shears, and there's also the whole idea of quality control. So the part of the, I guess, debate as to why it's a good thing is that it's there to help rehabilitate and let these guys learn a skill and a trade that they can potentially use when they eventually get out, and they can go start working in factory jobs and stuff like that.
And potentially, although it's a bad example in this film, potentially the money that is earned would go back to the state to help run prisons or whatever, and it's helps fund things that on top of taxes and all
Right,
that.
that's true. The very first state that began to make license plates in the prison system was Michigan, my home state, and they started in 1918. So, I mean, it's been going on for over a century, getting prisoners to create license plates. I mean, it's also very funny that they want a dozen volunteers. It's like, we'll talk more about it tomorrow and later and next week. But it looks like they could have used more men. The idea of special detail, special privileges, it's an interesting way that the camera moves as Norton talks, and it like then focuses on Red and Andy, who are right nearby there. And then we get Red continuing with his narration, and he goes, "It was outdoor detail. May is one damn fine month to be working outdoors." And we see Andy standing next to Red, and you have the rest of their posse all around. Everyone's just looking at Red. They're looking for Red to help them, to give them a little bit of I don't know, direction and what they need to do. And then one of the guards goes, "Stay in line there," because the shot changes, and we see men just walking by, putting their little slips of paper in a pail. And we see others that are writing on the pieces of paper, and we see a shot of Red throwing his paper in, and then he moseys over to one of the guards and starts whispering into his ear. And then Red says, "More than 100 men volunteered for the job." So to me, it makes no sense that only 100 people would volunteer unless they all knew it was a fix. That would be my guess. They're like, "Oh, damn, that guy Red, he's gonna be getting everyone. So, there's no point in me trying."
We ever find out how many prisoners are actually in the prison?
Nope,
No.
they never give us a count. I mean, we have some great camera shots if you want to, like,
Oh yeah,
freeze
there's
the
some
frame
like
and
the
try and count.
helicopter shots earlier on stuff,
That's right. If you want to freeze the frame and try and count, good luck. I won't do that.
Did you do that in that
I
episode?
did it. No, I didn't do it in this movie. I did it in The Great Escape at one point, where when he's about when he fails to make the jump over the fence, and you
Oh
have soldiers running from both sides. I did count how many soldiers were running at him from both sides. But no, I did not do that here. I didn't think that it was really necessary to try to
No.
figure out how many prisoners there are.
There's certainly more than a
Yes,
hundred.
it's interesting to try and think of it about it, you know, because it there's even no way to really even gauge to try and gauge how many prisoners there could be.
I guess you could argue maybe, 'cause, I mean, a lot of the film later on goes on about people getting institutionalized and things like that. You might get some people who are just so comfortable with their little job that they do all the time, they just don't like any sort of change anymore. You could argue that might be the case, but who knows?
Right. Again, it's funny. Like I just looked it up, and the first idea here is that you know, you should go by the number on the you know, the prisoners' numbers. And I'm like, okay, that doesn't fit at all,
Yeah.
because there's no way that they're talking about you know, 30 plus something, 30,000 plus
Oh,
inmates that have
yeah.
gone through Shawshank over the years or anything like that. I don't think. And also there's no rhyme or reason to the numbers, because Andy's number
Yeah.
and Faddis's number are really far apart, and we know they got there the exact same time. It was just
Yeah.
like, okay, these are the numbers that are currently available. I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's absolutely no way to try to figure that out. And I guess that's okay. But I still find it very interesting that there's only 100 that have volunteered, even if there's 1,000 men in Shawshank. Okay, my assumption is there's probably more. I would say that there's my guesstimation would be that there's anywhere between 1,500 and 2,000. That would be my rough guesstimation. But I definitely think that 100 is way too low.
Yeah, definitely.
But I also like the way that Red, you know, goes over to him and whispers into his ear.
Yeah. We talked about his kind of sly kind of ways of working there, I guess, in another episode, didn't we? But
That's
yeah,
right.
it is nice. And I like the cut as well. I assume it's the same guy as well. You see him talking to the that guard, and then immediately cut, and it's
That's
that
right.
same guy reading out the names. So you just to make it extra clear
It's
that it's, I
exact.
think
It's
it's
the
the
same
same
guy.
guy.
It's
It's
the same
hard
guy.
to tell in this.
We'll I'll talk about him tomorrow.
Yeah,
It's
yeah.
Guard Youngblood. Yeah, we'll get a better shot of him
Okay.
tomorrow, so we can talk more about it. But you know, it's funny. He starts going through the names, and he calls out Wallace E. Unger, and we have no idea which of the, you know, which of Red and Andy's friends this could be talking about, because you know, all these guys have nicknames. We don't know their real
Yeah,
names.
yeah.
You know, we know we have
Well,
Skeet and
we
Jigger
get
and
the.
Floyd and Snooze. You know, those are their names.
But again, like it's done visually, I guess, because we get this really nice. I love the little turn from Morgan Freeman, his little smile. There were just the way the shot works as well. We pull back, and then Morgan Freeman turns around, and then you cut
That's right.
to his mates, and William Sadler has a little giggle playing on his. Because as I say, his character has a little bit of a childlike nature to him in places. He's not the brightest spark, and that little like kind of noddy sort of giggle that he does is quite a it's quite nice.
Okay, so if you count when they're all standing in front of Norton, so there's basically they're 10 deep, and then across you have, I count 17 rows, but there's probably more. Okay, so if they're 10 deep, that would say
Really?
that they're only 200 men.
Well, they might operate
Maybe.
in wings and things, I guess. Might not have everyone out at once.
Again, they're not going to be able to get 2,000 extras just for this little side. You know, they don't need it.
No.
Yeah, it's I like the way that they play this out, you know, the whole thing. The guard once again calls out a name, and he goes, Ellis Redding. And as he's doing this, we get the narration from Red, where he continues and goes, wouldn't you know it, me and some fellows I know were among the names. And we hear the guard say William H, and we have absolutely no idea who William would be. And then the guard continues and goes, Andy Dufresne. And we see Rin and all his friends are quite happy here. And then the shot changes, and we see someone hoisting up a bucket filled with tar.
I like that shot as well. It's kind of looking off the edge of the side of the building, and then it kind of follows the bucket up. It's quite cool. Oh well,
We
we
don't
don't
see the
quite
end
see
of
the
it,
end of
but
it,
it
I
is a
suppose.
great shot where it's coming up there. And then Red continues and says, "It only costs us a pack of smokes per man." Now, it's funny that he says it only cost us, meaning that the guard Youngblood is the one who was collecting on it. It's not that Red said, "All right, I'm going to be able to deal with this for you." He made a deal with Youngblood, and even Red has to pay for it. That type of thing.
Well, I guess that's how it works. Like, he'll get more money from the prisoners and
Right. But
gives a
to
little
me, it's
less to
also a
the
little
guard
strange
to
that
get out,
the
usually.
guard actually wants, 12 packs of cigarettes. Like, what does he need
I
12
want the
packs of cigarettes
cigarettes.
for?
Yeah, that's true.
I guess so.
Well, they cost some money, I
That's
guess,
true.
you know. Save some pennies.
It's very
Probably not
possible.
paid much.
As the tar gets hoisted up, that's where this minute ends. So did you have anything else you wanted to add?
The one thing I would mention that's also nice in this is just to go back to the music. So the previous montage, I talked about how it had that kind of slow, mournful sort of thing going on, but there's a real clear, total shift in the tone of the music in this scene, in this sequence. When it cuts to as soon as it cuts to the warden talking about taking over from the voiceover, if you will, and telling us about the job that needs doing, the music suddenly becomes more. You get this kind of slightly jaunty sort of fiddle coming in, and it just totally changes the tone of everything, which is the idea of this whole the scene that's about to come up. It's quite a tone shifter in general, but yeah, the music helps cue that in quite nicely. So I just wanted to mention that.
Right. Well, it makes sense that they would want to change the tone of things at this point,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
because this is, the next week will be a very pivotal scene in the story of Andy and Shawshank,
Yeah.
that type of thing. Today's segment is called Andy Do Thursday,
Tim
where my guests will give their top five
Robbins.
Tim Robbins performances. So why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Right. So yeah, I am gonna go number five. I'm gonna go with Arlington Road. Yeah, which sees Tim Robbins play a very dark, mysterious sort of character. So yeah, I enjoyed that a lot. And then number four, total shift from that, is the Hudsucker Proxy, where he plays a seemingly at first glance dim-witted kind of character who becomes very successful, and it's a whole lot of fun. Coen Brothers at the kind of playful best. It's great. And then a much darker comedy, number three. I'm going to go with The Player, with Robert Altman, one of Robert Altman's best films. It's absolutely superb. I haven't seen it for a long time. I must rewatch that. And number two, I'm going to go with Shawshank Redemption. Shawshank's probably my favourite film of the five. But if we're going by Tim Robbins' performance, I had to go for number one. I'm going to go with Jacob's Ladder. Which is still a great film, but I think I probably prefer Shawshank. But Tim Robbins' performance in that is fantastic, and he really has to go through the ringer. It's a really powerful film, really interesting, very stylish film, and well worth
Interesting.
watching. So
I
yeah,
was actually
I had that
expecting
as my number one.
your number one to be something else. I thought you were going to go with Mystic River there.
No, yeah, I almost put that in there, but I don't know. I need to rewatch Mystic River. It's one I saw quite a while ago. Not straight away when it first came out, but I've not seen it since, and I just can't remember it that much. It didn't. I can remember thinking it was a great film, but I can't really remember the details, and I just can't really remember Tim Robbins in it. So it didn't make enough of an
Okay,
impression on me.
again,
I think I need to
that is
rewatch it.
fair. You're allowed. You are allowed. Right, so now we will move on to the first of two daily games. Which one do you want to do first?
Let's go for the let's humiliate me first with the novel to adaptation one, because I just really struggled with this one.
Right, well, we'll start with name that novel adaptation.
I'm obviously not reading enough.
Let's spin the wheel and see what you get. This one, I actually have a feeling you're going to get. So this is a movie from 2002 where the original title is The Orchid Thief.
Oh, this is adaptation.
Exactly.
Yes.
Nicely done, nicely done. All right, and now we will play the second daily game of High Low. Let's spin the wheel for your first of three. The 2011 film The Help.
Okay. I'm gonna go with a 7.2 IMDb and a 80 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay, you are slightly off. The IMDb is 8.1. Yeah. And Rotten
Wow.
Tomatoes is 76. Yeah, I actually like that
Okay,
movie a
I'm quite a
lot.
bit off on IMDb then.
It's not as good on a rewatch, but it's still a very interesting and poignant story, so I like it.
I can't remember if I've seen it all. I've definitely seen chunks of it, but I feel like it was one that was on TV
Well,
and I
it's never
missed the
too late to
start
try
of it
and
or
catch
something.
up to
I can't
it.
remember.
All right, let's spin the wheel for your next one. The 2009 film Precious.
Precious.
And it's not starring Gollum.
Sorry, I know the one. I would go with it was quite critically acclaimed. Maybe this could be quite high. I'm gonna go with 7.6 IMDb, and then I'm gonna go with a 90 Rotten Tomatoes. Seem to
Very
remember it
good.
being well
Very,
reviewed.
very close. Very close. It's 7.3 on IMDb and a
Okay.
92
Okay. No, not far off.
on Rotten Tomatoes. All right, fair enough. All right, let's go for the final one. All right, David, show me the money.
Yes, Jerry
1996,
Maguire.
Jerry Maguire.
Oh, okay. I'm going to go with 7.7 IMDb, and it was pretty well reviewed from what I remember. I'm going to go with, but would it be that high? I'm going to go with, I'm going to risk it. I'm going to go 90. I think it was quite well regarded. I might be wrong.
You overshot both of them, so it's 7.3 on IMDb and 84.
Okay, not a million miles off.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. So David, would you like to once again tell people where they can find David Brooke?
Hey, you can find me at blueprintreview.co.uk.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Midnight. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, and you can find me on my website, moviearoundmidnight.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierob@movierob.net. So, I actually was gonna ask you about how. So Shawshank came out 32 years ago. And you talked about the fact that it's a movie that you like to revisit every I guess decade or so or whatever it is, but it's something that you always remember and think about it. What, why do you think that it didn't do so well in the box office and, at the Oscars that year and stuff like that? What are your thoughts on that?
I think partly it didn't make a lot of money because it's got a terrible title. I think it's not immediately appealing. I mean, it's difficult to say now because it's so well known now. But Shawshank Redemption, when you first see that and don't know anything about it, I just say I know it's based on a Stephen King, but it's a Stephen King short story within another within a book, so people wouldn't immediately know the title. And it's I think the title was a big put off for audiences originally. I think it just took time for word of mouth to kind of spread. As for it not winning the Oscars, the Oscars, a lot of it is more about is more about the what's the word? It's more about how well it was pushed to the voters and things, really. It's very political, the Oscars. I don't mean necessarily in a Democrat Republican sense. I mean more in terms of you get teams selling the films to the voters and just and getting and because it wasn't a very successful film, just people weren't talking about it. It just didn't have that momentum yet. And there were some other strong films knocking around that year. I
Well,
don't see, what was it?
1994. That's it. Yeah.
Was that the year that
Yeah.
Forrest was that the year that Forrest
It was
Gump
Forrest
won?
Gump, Shawshank, Pulp Fiction, Quiz Show, and Four Weddings and a Funeral. I mean, that is a stellar lineup.
Yeah, it's quite a mixed one. But it what's surprising is that I think to me at least, I think is that because Forrest Gump won most a lot of the bigger ones, didn't it? And it's I feel like that's a film I haven't rewatched it in a while, but I feel like it's a film that probably hasn't held up very well. I feel like some of the there are some aspects of it that just don't always work. But I feel when it originally came out as well, I didn't feel like it was universally loved. It's clever and it's fun, but certainly now I think Tom Hanks's performance might be seen as being a bit problematic. So yeah, it's interesting that that's the one that kind of got the most plaudits, whereas I think some of the other films that were up are more kind of universally loved these days. An interesting one.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. David and I will be back tomorrow to finish up the week. But until then, get busy living.
Or get busy dying.